You're listening to Warming People Up to Jesus, God, and Faith, The Value of Spirituality Surveys and Questions in Initiating Spiritual Conversations by Calvin Weber. Calvin is the Campus Ministry Director at BCIT with British Columbia Campus Ministries. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 8, 2014 at Willingdon Church.
Of technology with British Columbia Campus Ministries. So, I thank you for coming. And if you have a little outline, basically it's just a very simple outline. You can turn it over on the back and write out the real notes, things that catch your attention, or just keep that as a way of remembering some of the key points or keywords that I'm using. So, I've been doing some campus ministry for about 30 years, but I feel like I've had a breakthrough in my own way of thinking and doing evangelism in the last 3 or 4 years. And it has been tightly connected with this whole idea of spiritual conversations and using questionnaires. I did questionnaires in the past, but in the past my questionnaires were a little different in terms of the philosophy behind the questionnaire. It was more like entrapment, you know. Are you going to hell? 2-question test will reveal the answer. Oh, I don't know, you know, and all of a sudden they're on the defensive, and you're on, you know. And really, I went to a seminar by Dr. Krish Kandaya from Oxford University at Regent College, and he had a course called Sub-Zero Evangelism. You can get that from Regent College, bookstore or library, order on the website. But Sub-Zero Evangelism, what is that? What his point was, and he lives in England where there's even less people going to church than Canada, and his point was, we're not dealing with people that are just sort of neutral to the gospel and to Christianity. We're dealing with people that are cold to the... He wasn't talking about Canadian weather. He was talking about the state of people's heart and soul and receptivity to things, especially Christian things. People are pretty open to spiritual things, but not so much to physical things. And so, Christian things. So, I want to talk first about mindsets, then I want to talk about the actual spiritual questionnaire, and then I would like to talk a little bit about some of the examples, some of the conversations I've had, and then I would like to finally, and fourthly, talk about how usually some of the best conversations end, on what theme. And I have discovered that in doing the spirituality conversations and questionnaires, that I've been ending up in the same place again and again. And I've become very excited about it. So when I first wanted to do spirituality questionnaires, I was pretty nervous about it. But now it's like, let me out there, you know? And that's what happens when you do it more than once or 5 or 10 times. So let's start with mindsets. Because I think I needed a change of mindset to embrace what I am now doing in terms of spiritual conversations. And I must confess, I'm an introvert. And so I'm not naturally a public speaker. I can do this, but it's not my sweet spot. I'm more of a read a book, write an essay, you know, do some studies. This is tad on the edge of my personality type, you know what I'm saying? But it's good. I can do this by God's grace. But I needed some mindset changes, and especially for an introvert who's a little bit afraid of introducing himself to complete strangers. Now, as a campus minister, I needed to do that just to raise support. So, you know, I'd introduce myself and say, hey, I'm doing campus ministry. Let me tell you the vision for our ministry. Would you be open to that? So, yeah, I'd like to hear what you guys are doing to reach university students for the Lord. So I'd walk through what we're doing at UBC or at BCIT. And then I'd say, would you like to support this in prayer and finances? And some would say yes and some would say no. But I was getting used to talking to complete strangers. But they were friendly ones because they were Christians. But what would this look like? I'm not asking for money. I'm asking for their salvation. So what would it look like if I'm talking to atheists? So I got nervous about that. And, I've really warmed up to this idea of how to approach people respectfully and conversationally and not adversarially. I am a person when I do my personality tests, that is afraid of conflict or likes to avoid conflict. It's just the way I am. And so if you want to do evangelism and you think it's going to be conflictual, then you don't want to do it. And I realized that, you know what, I don't necessarily think having a conflict-minded evangelistic paradigm is a good one. And so I don't think Jesus had a conflict-minded paradigm when he was meeting with sinners. He fell into conflict with Pharisees, but with the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the lepers and the other people, Jesus was the holiest guy on earth, and he seemed to be able to make friendships and have amazing rapport with the greatest sinners on earth. I thought, I like that. I want to be like that. So here's some of the mindsets. Number one, I have to confess I'm an introvert. Number two, I went to a little seminar and I heard Mike Bedell from the island say, people are more open than you think, and you're more prepared than you think. And I had to go, you know what? I'm right. That's right. I'm meeting people and I'm discovering that there is an openness. I was afraid they weren't open. And actually, if you get it off on the right foot, they're actually more open than you think. And then a lot of people say, number one fear is I'm not prepared. I don't have anything to say. If you read the Bible, if you've been sitting in church, if you've been hearing sermons, you've been reading books, you've got a lot of preparation. You've got a lot of stuff in your mind and in your heart, more than you think. And guess what? If you step out into a conversation with somebody, the Holy Spirit can bring up the stuff you've studied and read and heard in the past. And you'll find it coming out. And the more you do it, the easier it comes out. So those are two truths as well. I decided to call something permission evangelism. And what I mean by that is, I ask people permission to ask them questions. Could I ask you a question? And then they go, sure. Well, I've asked their permission. Now it's okay to ask them a question. And then I ask them, could I give you my perspective on that question? Sure. Okay, now I've got their permission again. So I like permission evangelism. I don't mean permissive evangelism. I mean permission, granted, evangelism, where they're saying, yes, I welcome this spiritual conversation. When I was a kid, a young teenager, even going to church, I never had serious conversations with people on serious subjects. And in the back of my mind, I always wanted to have one or two. How many times have I had a conversation with a student that said, man, that was really cool. That was neat. That was really deep. I'm thinking, you raised some thoughts here that I've never thought before, but thank you very much. Now that's kind of cool. Makes you want to do it again. When people thank you for raising questions and raising deeper issues. And they're going to university and they're not having these deep conversations. G.K. Chesterton says in his book Orthodoxy, I had always felt life first a story. And if there is a story, then there is a storyteller. And so the important role of stories as a theme, as well as a practice, I've been merging into evangelism. Used to be, I just had my Pauline texts and I would just point them on the Romans road to salvation. No context of story. Not their story, not the big narrative, not my story. It was just, you're a sinner, but he wants to save you through what Jesus did on the cross. Boom. And some logic. And it's all good. It's all true. But what about story? People respond to story. People have stories. God has a story. You're in a story. And history is about story. So I believe we need to know the big story. And so I started thinking broadly from Genesis to Revelation. What's the big story? What are we supposed to be telling people? And when we meet with them, what are we supposed to be processing here? What about a story? So tell your story. Tell the stories of others that are good and illustrated truth. But most of all, ask for and listen to their stories. I found that evangelism was more me talking and what if evangelism is you listening? So that you know where they're at, so that what you do say hits a bullseye instead of scares them away. And so that's where you want to listen to their stories and be a good listener, an active listener. So let me ask you, did I hear you right when you said? I mean, you want to know what their story is and not be afraid of it. And find out, when I'm listening to these stories, because I'm asking questions before I preach a gospel. I'm asking questions. I'm drawing them out. And so I want to know, what makes this person tick? Where in this person's life is there a connection point that I could connect with, that God is connecting with? That's what I want. I'm a detective. I'm looking for clues. I want to see, what has God done in their life? And they didn't even recognize that God's been at work in their life. That's what I'm looking for. So sometimes, you know, I just will continue to draw out their story because I'm sensing that God was at work in that story. There's a place of reality. God's a real God with real people and real life. And so it's a real gospel. They're going to connect. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the connection between their story, my story, God's story, Jesus' parables, and what have you. I've been told, and this is so true, that the Bible is a narrative. It's a big story. It's God's story. It's like the series of acts in a play. I'm not talking about the book of Acts. I'm talking about a play. Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, Act 4. Act 1, obviously the creation. And that's a good backdrop. It starts out good. A God of love who creates us for relationship and beauty and for purpose and for co-laboring with Him and in finding out all that is there within creation for the common good of all. I mean, there's a big storyline just in that first act. Second act is, of course, the fall, the free will, and we've been hearing some of that in the speakers today. Then the third act is God forming a people, Israel, and giving them that first covenant and the commandments that would enhance relational communal life. If you follow the commandments, you'll have the best communal relational life on earth. And if you don't, well, then things break down pretty fast. They don't follow it. Things do break down. The fourth act is Jesus, the new covenant, the new commandment. And then the fifth act is Acts and the epistles and the new church, the new Israel, the new people of God. And then the sixth act is what we're in right now. It's not written down. We're writing it. But if you know the first act, the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth act, you will properly live out the sixth act. You'll be in continuity with what's gone before you, and you've read Revelations. You know what the seventh act is going to be. Jesus' return and the recreation and reconstitution of all things. The making right of all things. So we're living in that middle, in that sixth act, knowing the first five, knowing about the seventh. And so that sixth act, we can, you know, make sure that storyline is compatible with everything that's gone before it and what's going ahead of us. Anyway, that's beside the point, I guess. But the story is about what? Redemption. The restoration of broken relationships with God, with others, with ourselves, because there's that internal breaking in the fall, and with creation. So there's four areas here that God's working on. And we've often in the past just emphasized restoring that relationship with God. And then we think, oh yeah, restoring relationship with your neighbors. But then we think, oh yeah, restoring that brokenness within my soul. And then we've begun become a little more aware, you know what, we need to restore our relationship with the environment, creation care. And so all those things are happening. They're all part of the big story. It's a love story that we're introducing people to. It's a let's right the wrongs story. It's a heroic story. You're a major character in this story. But Jesus is the hero of this story. And we want to introduce other people and treat them like major characters in God's story, but also introduce them to the hero. But there's also an antagonist in the story. You know, Satan, amongst others. So, anyway, I began to feel like I needed a change of emphasis regarding evangelism from maybe just the package that I had memorized to something bigger and holistic, and that's been helpful as well. And in introducing people to other parts of the story. So I find myself when I'm talking to one person and they think that just being a good person, God would let them into heaven, I'm immediately thinking of the story of the good young ruler, the rich young ruler. Says, Jesus, what good things must I do to get into heaven? He says, have you kept the commandments? Yeah, I've kept them all. What about? Boom. And so now I've got a story. It may be the women at the well in Samaria. It might be Nicodemus coming privately at night and talking about being born again. It might be the prodigal son or the woman caught in adultery. Krish Kandai, in his course on sub-zero evangelism at Regent College, made this one point. He says, we've got a lot of theologians who've done no evangelism. And we've got a lot of evangelists that haven't studied deeply theology. What we really need is theologians that evangelize and evangelists that know theology. We need theologically rich evangelism. And so I just leave that for you to develop. But we do need both of these, very much so. And I believe more of this is now happening. As I read Timothy Keller, I think he's a good model of somebody who's always thinking missionally, but he's thinking theologically as well. And C.S. Lewis has already done that. John Dixon in Australia, Scott McKnight, some of the people that have influenced me. We must see God as an evangelist. Do you see God as an evangelist? He has a message that he wants to communicate and draw people to himself. We are people with good news from God. We have a testimony to share. We have a story to tell. We have an invitation to convey. We have hospitality to offer. We have a model to present. And we have an answer to give. We also have a question we can ask just to kind of prime the pump and kickstart the conversation at times. It's been helpful for me to understand that people are in a spiritual journey. And so you have a gauge from minus 10 to, I don't know, plus 10, and there's that middle line where you cross into saving faith with Christ. And I'm meeting a lot of people minus 10 or minus 5. Either they're hostile to Christianity in particular or to religion in general and the idea of a God specifically, or they're just uninformed. Nobody's taught them. Their parents didn't go to church. They didn't go to church. They're not listening to Christian radio, Christian TV, and they're not picking up Christian journals and the Christian Bible. And they're not hearing it now in schools. And so they really don't know anything. And so my goal is to see people. I want to see people saved. I want to see people get saved. But you can't see a person get saved that's minus 10 or minus 5 with one conversation. Usually not. I mean, you need an angelic visitation and an earthquake all simultaneously for that to happen. Really, what I would still be encouraged with is to see them move from minus 10 to minus 7 with a positive encounter. I like them to start doubting their doubts through the conversations that we have and through the loving model that is presented. I like to see the person with a minus 5 become a minus 2, and they're getting close. It's very cool when you're working with somebody that's a minus 1 and they're right on the threshold of coming to faith in Christ, where they cross that line. And then the other half of our ministry is seeing people that are Christians become spiritually vibrant and theologically informed and becoming more like Christ and engaged in Christian mission and becoming leaders and not just followers. But that's another seminar. Okay, where are we here? Leslie Newbigin writes or tells us that the most challenging missionary frontier of our time is the pagan society born out of rejection of Christianity. It's far more resistant to the gospel than the pre-Christian paganism with which cross-cultural missions has been familiar. So when you meet somebody in the burnt-out religious West, it's harder to get them interested than to go to some place, like when I was in China, we were just having conversations about Christ all the time. People were genuinely interested. And here in North America, less so. Why? Because they think we've tried it and it has failed. But the people I'm talking to at the university in China, they haven't tried it yet. In fact, they look at the West in a long historical period from the Middle Ages to the present and say, why did the West eclipse China in technology? What if it's got something to do with their Christian religion? But the people here aren't even thinking like that. But over there they are. So, it's kind of cool. How do we witness in a pluralistic, relativistic, post-Christian, pagan society? People believe in science. I don't know how many students have told me, I believe in science. And they believe in what they think are facts. So when you talk about values and religious beliefs, they think, well, that's just a matter of personal opinion and personal choice. We need to have, I believe, a relational, dialogical approach with our non-religious or anti-religious neighbors. We need to open up lines of communication, engage in spiritual conversations, and we need to be positioned to respond to those with objections and to those who know little to or nothing about our faith or about spirituality. And there's a few doctrines that we should be able to affirm, and so I'll just mention them to you so you can just look in the theology textbooks and draw out how these things can help us in our evangelism. One is common grace. God gifts everybody. He wants rain to fall on everybody, sunshine to fall on everybody. He wants blessings to go out to everybody, no matter what religion or irreligion they are of. General revelation, God is revealing himself not just through the book. That's the specific way he reveals himself, the best way, but he reveals himself through nature and through the world that's created around us, the book of nature. There's the doctrine of providence. God is providentially at work in non-Christians' lives and Christians' lives. And, of course, there's a biblical anthropology. We are created, though fallen, we are created in God's image. And there's something still left of that image, as marred as it is, that I like to remember when I go and talk to a non-Christian. I like to remember, you know what, there's something on the inside of this person that is agreeing with me. There's something on the inside of this person that is saying, in the subconscious soul, rescue me. Save me. Life should be better than it is. I wonder what that looks like. And you've got the picture of what it looks like. It's Jesus. And so there's always something in every person you're talking to that will agree with you, even though you're getting the disagreement at times. But I like to find the agreement because there's a common ground at work there because of God in his world. Yvonne Richmond writes this: I have begun to expect to see signs of God's work in people's lives. Whatever the religious commitment or circumstances, this led me to inquire about these people's experiences and their belief in God as if they already know him. Maybe they don't know him correctly. And they willingly spoke about these in conversations of mutual sharing and respect. People will talk about their experiences, their beliefs, their feelings. They will talk about them if you don't shut them down by prematurely putting pressure and saying, I've got the right way, you got the wrong way. That's a judgment. But just in a conversation, a mutual respect, where you're secure in your relationship with Jesus and you're secure in the sovereignty of God, you will create an environment where you can have a better conversation with the person that doesn't have the same faith as you. Religions are a preparation. They provide ideas about God that you can share and talk about. Well, so how do you see God as? And so why don't you believe in that God? Well, you know what? I don't believe in that God either. But that's not the God I'm talking about. Oh, what's the God you're talking about? And then you can redefine what God is based on Scripture and your experience. Well, you know, if God is really like that, yeah, I'd be a little warmer to that idea of God than the God I just presented, and things like that. Wilson studies computer science at BCIT. His mother grew up Catholic, but she left the church. Wilson had no religious beliefs. He claimed he was not a spiritual person. He says, I don't know why I'm doing a spiritual survey. I'm not a spiritual person. And yet when asked who he would love to have lunch with, he chose Gandhi. Of all people in the world, I'd like to have lunch with Gandhi. I want to know what he believed, his perspective on the world. Then I asked him what kind of question he'd ask God. He said, well, he started listing several questions he'd like to ask God. Most people, they struggle and give you one. This guy had a list of them. How does God keep track of everyone? Why does he care for one person over another person? How is it he allows one region of the world to be well off and another reason not to be well off? Earlier in the questionnaire, he said his goal was to in life was to be happy. So I said, what do you mean by happy? What would make you happy? Well, close friendships would make me happy. And so he was open when I started sharing with him about the priority God and Jesus have for close friendships, for relationships, for loving relationships. And he accepted a copy of the New Testament to find out more about what Jesus taught in how he lived. He had never had one before. Francis Schaeffer wrote this: there's common ground between the Christian and the non-Christian because, regardless of man's system of belief or philosophy, he has to live in God's world. There's common ground. There's a place where we can connect with people. Is Newbegin right when he comments, in making the gospel known to any race of men anywhere, we bring them nothing strange. We bring them the secret of their own being. The revelation of the true source of their own life. We bring them, in effect, the light they already have. Maybe a faint light. The light that enlightens every man, which is Jesus, the great light. And then later on, he writes in the Gospel in a pluralistic society, he says, all human beings have longed for ultimate happiness. That's often true in my conversations, in my surveys. So we must believe that this longing is something implanted in us by God. He has so made us that we have infinite desires beyond their satisfaction of our biological necessities, desires which only God Himself can satisfy. Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in Him. The gospel breaks into this self-centered search for our own happiness. I want to know that God's already at work in people's lives before I approach them. I mean, it's encouraging to me. It reduces my fear levels from a minus 10 to like a minus 2. To know that God's already doing something in their life and that they're more open than I thought. It's very cool. Remember the famous saying of C.S. Lewis? If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. I love that. I need to know that God is already at work in people's lives before I come along. And the more I talk with people, the more I meet with people, the more I realize this is true. And hence, I need not be afraid. Yeah. So, my objective is ultimately to point people to Jesus and then let Jesus point them to God. People say, aren't there many paths to God? No. But I allow this. There are many paths to Jesus. And then Jesus is the one path that takes you to God. Just a thought. People say, does everybody go to heaven? No. But Jesus goes to everyone. And that's our goal, is to bring Jesus to everyone so that He can then take them to heaven. You get to become a close friend of God through being a close friend of Jesus. What is special about Jesus? He shows us what God is like and makes a way to enter into the kind of relationship He has with the Father. So if you can actually explain a little bit of the relationship Jesus has with God, it's the kind of relationship that He's inviting you into as well. That kind of friendship and intimacy. So we're to show people what God is like. Did you know that Jesus actually, in the New Testament Gospels, it's recorded there's 295 questions that Jesus asks. So I began to think, if Jesus uses questions to engage His audience, maybe we should too. So I developed a survey with 295 questions, but I couldn't ever get it through with anybody. Not kidding. 10 is about as far as you want to go. Questions open doors. Not badgering questions which close doors. But not set-up questions. Not questions with a true-false answer right off the start and they're afraid they'll give you the wrong answer. But just fair questions. Important questions. And on campus, I use a formal spirituality questionnaire to open up a conversation about life and faith. And I've done these in city parks. I've done them on city sidewalks. And you don't need to use a survey to do this. You can just ask people questions naturally as you connect with them in your friendships. Opportunities will frequently arise to ask questions and converse about things that are important to other people, what's the next stage or goal in their life, and so on. And you know what? People just like to talk about themselves. A lot of people do. Let them. Listen. I've had over 100 of these conversations at BCIT. And the thing I want to do is walk through the 10 or 12 questions that I have here and just to acquaint you with the number of questions and how those go for me, and then walk through a few more examples of how those conversations have played out. Pray before you do a questionnaire. And you could do this by yourself, but you could do it with a team of two. It increases your own encouragement. This is how I start the questionnaire. Hi, would you be willing to participate in a student spirituality questionnaire? It's that simple. I say that 99 times out of 100. And they can say no, and I said, "That no worries, thank you, and have a great day." But it doesn't take long for somebody to say yes. And I never know which person I'm going to talk to is going to say yes and which one's going to say no. And so I've learned just to forget about, you know, guessing as to who's going to say yes or no. And just sometimes the Holy Spirit prompts me, go to that person. Other times I'm just, and think great things happen. I don't say, are you interested or would you like to do a survey? Because I feel like most people, probably that wasn't their goal during the day, was to engage in a survey. And so it's not on their bucket list. And so I just avoid the deal. Would you like to do a survey with me today? No, not really. But would you be willing to? Well, you know, okay, yeah, I'd be willing to. You know, and so we go from there. Introduce yourself, but don't insist on their name. I leave a little bit of privacy and anonymity if that's what the person wants. By the way, you can make up your own survey, pick out your own questions, experiment with different questions, and see how that works out for you. And review the results and learn from the results. So my first question is, what are you studying? But you could, not all of you are going to be having a campus as your mission field. You could say, well, I'm doing a community spirituality questionnaire. What is your occupation? What's your life full of? So, number two, what's your greatest goal in life? If they say happiness, I want to ask, what makes you happy? You know, because that's just not enough. And then maybe they'll say, well, lots of money. Then I might say, well, what will the money be used for that would make you happy? You see where I'm going? I want to get a little bit more specific with them. Maybe they want to graduate and get a job. And then I say, well, what next after that? And then I get to the real meat and potatoes, you know? And sometimes nobody gives you the best answer the first time. And it starts to leak out. What's deep in their heart starts to come out as you build a little bit of rapport and set them at ease. And there's no right or wrong answer. It's not a final test. You won't get graded. And it doesn't cost a thing. And you can go from there. And often people will say, well, you know what? I want to get married. I want to have family. And that's what I need the money for. Oh, you want to support your family. That's very cool. And then I go to the next question. How about, what is your or your parents' spiritual religious background? And they'll say, well, you know what? My parents didn't go to church. I have no religious background. We're not spiritual. The other person might say, well, we're Catholic background, Catholic raised. But I stopped going. Or I might find that somebody's a Buddhist background or a Hindu background, Sikh background, Muslim background, maybe a practicing. And so I find out what their religious or irreligious background is. And that's really helpful. Four, what are your present spiritual religious practices or basic beliefs? Now, if they mention that they have a little bit of religious affiliation, that'll make more sense to them. If they've got zero religious affiliation, then I just say, well, I skip the practices and then just say, well, what do you believe about God? Well, I'm a total atheist. I don't think there is a God. Or I'm kind of agnostic. Or they might not say it, but that's what they mean. Yeah, I think there is something out there, you know? I'd like to know that. What do they think? Is there a God or not? Well, what does God look like? I really don't know. You know, and so I get a bit there. And I'm sensing, how engaged are they in faith or religion? How committed are they or not? Then I ask them this question. It doesn't matter who they are. I said, why do you think people turn away from religion or turn to it? And I get answers from every single person I talk to. Well, I think people turn to religion because they need a crutch. Or I think they turn away from it because they're just sick and tired of all the hypocrisy and the wars that religion creates. Or I think people turn to religion because they were born into it, you know, and they're just raised in it, and their family members are in it. Or they have a need, or because this came from someplace, you know. Or they turn away from religion because they don't have enough proof. Or because they prioritize other things and they just sort of get peer pressure and they just sort of follow other interests and just lose, you know? So I get tons of wonderful answers to that question. What are your favorite movies or books? All of a sudden it doesn't sound like it's spiritual anymore at all. It's cultural. But sometimes, you know, Shawshank Redemption has come up. Da Vinci Code has come up, you know, but other things have come up, you know, the movie 300 has come up, goodness sakes, just about everything, you know, has come up in these conversations. Books, I learn about books that I didn't know about, authors I didn't know about, and then sometimes I even ask them about music. This next one opens up a lot of doors. Who would you want to have lunch with? Anyone in the world, throughout history, language not a barrier. And so I've had ranges from, like, I would have loved to have lunch with my grandfather, but he died when I was really young, and I've heard some good things about him, but I'd just like to have lunch with my grandfather. I'm going, aww. I mean, you know, that's so amazing. And think of that. And then another guy said, oh, I'd like to have lunch with Hitler. Get inside that guy's head. Figure out what in the world he was thinking. You know, or I'd like to have lunch with Einstein because the guy loves science. And then another guy says, I want to have lunch with a supermodel. And then the next person is saying, I want to have lunch with Wayne Gretzky. And I've heard 100 different versions. Let's just put it that way. I could write a book, people I'd like to have lunch with, or other people would like to have lunch with. 8, have you ever experienced something you can't explain, be it mystical, magical, or miraculous? No, remember, we're not in Hawaii, where 80% of the people say they've had some kind of a spiritual, supernatural experience, or know of somebody who did. We're in Vancouver, but I'm still trending at about 25% response of something specific or general in this category of supernatural experience. Maybe deja vu, that's something they believe was more than coincidence. May have been a dream that came true. Might have been a miracle healing. Usually it's a ghost story. Kid you not. A couple, especially some of the Asian students who have gone to funerals and then their ancestor was channeled by another person in the room and they spoke through that person 2 times. Wow. It's like my hair and my skin is, you know, responding to all of that. Then my big question, if you had a question to ask God, what would it be? And I'll get back to that. And I even say, well, how do you think God would answer that? And then I invite him to, you know, maybe, usually if I'm listening well to them, they will invite me into the conversation at this point. Or allow me, I think I've earned by listening well and not trying to corner them. I'm allowed into the conversation. I might be able to pick up on something. You know what? I heard that your greatest goal was this, and now you've got this particular question. They're related. And then I maybe have something to say about that. So here's some summaries that I have of people I've surveyed. Henry studies electrical engineering at BCIT. He's an atheist from a Buddhist family, and he wants a good job. He says peer pressure keeps him away from faith and prayer. He loves action films. He wonders if there's a heaven or a hell and which he would go to and why, hoping he's done enough good to lead him to heaven. He accepts the New Testament after hearing about Jesus and his way to heaven, but he realistically isn't ready to put his faith in this. It's enough for him to consider there might actually be a real God, an atheist. Jay's in the Millwright program at BCIT. His greatest goal in life is to be happy by having quality people around, being healthy and financially comfortable. He's an agnostic, as were his parents. His favorite movie, Pulp Fiction. His favorite book, The Wealthy Barber. He would like to have lunch with Jesus. No. Yeah. He had a supernatural experience. One night he was out walking, and he saw this little girl walking past this bush. It's dark, and then the girl never came out the other side of the bush. She just disappeared. He went and looked around the bush. He could not find this girl. She just vanished. And he was wondering, did he just see a ghost? His question to God was, what's the meaning of life? He welcomed a gift of a New Testament. Vito's studying civil engineering, desires to finish school, get a good job, make money, and be healthy. He's a Muslim from Iran. He attends mosque twice a week. He loves soccer, and he loves gangster movies, like The Godfather. Who would he like to have lunch with, besides his grandfather, Al Pacino? And Ronaldo. Yeah, the greatest soccer player ever. So he thinks that when some dreams come true, that this is evidence of the supernatural. Muslim dreams. He wants to ask God respectfully, what is going to happen after death? He knows the Quran's rules. He thinks that heaven is for those who are good, hell's for those who are evil. But he was interested to hear that only Jesus kept all the rules. And he became our substitute, exchanging his goodness for our sins so that we could be with God in heaven by grace and by a gift through faith. Vito accepted the gift of a New Testament to learn for the first time ever about Jesus Christ. Frankel studies biomedical engineering. He wants to have success in his career. He wants a stable life. Neither he nor his parents have a religious background. They're from Hong Kong. He believes in science. He wants to eat lunch with Einstein. He didn't think he had any supernatural experiences. Nope. But then he asked if dreams count. I says, what kind of dreams? And what do you dream about? So he said, well, his dreams were full of fantasy, and he was a superhero in his dreams that was with superpowers. And I said, well, is that scientific? No. And so I asked him, you know, is there something inside of you that's trying to tell your brain that there's more to life than what science can explain? He says, I never thought of it before, like that before. Yeah, I think there's something there. His question to God, why are we created? Chris is in fourth year computer science at UBC, and he wanted to enjoy life and success, and he would ask God, what's the point of this? Floating on a rock through space. And I point to Jesus and the purpose of life being love and a relationship with God and others, and was reminded of a story. The first question God asked in Genesis after Adam and Eve sinned was, where are you? This is the very first question God asked in the Bible. Where are you? Why? Jesus, God, they're interested in relationships. Wow. No matter what you've done, Adam and Eve sinned, no matter what you've done, God wants to restore the relationship. And it just goes on and on and on. We just got a few minutes left, so I'll just skip over some of these other examples. But I want to just be able to say that the number one question that people are asking God is the purpose question. I wasn't expecting that when I first did the survey. I didn't expect, what's the purpose for my life? Why did he make mankind? Is he just watching us and being amused, you know? But no. The purpose question. And the number two question is the suffering question. Why do some people suffer and others don't? And so, usually, they've already indicated that their main goal is to have great relationships, good marriage. And so sometimes I ask them, and some of them want money and success. Sometimes I ask this question as a little, you know, at the end I can do this. If you had a choice between being as rich as Jimmy Patterson but having zero friends, I'm not saying Jimmy's got zero friends, but having zero friends and broken relationship, your wife divorced you, your kids will never talk to you, but you've got all the money you can imagine, or if you had the greatest marriage, the greatest kids, close friends, but just enough to survive, which life would you choose? I've asked this question to many students, atheists, agnostics, everyone has said the relationships. Every single one of them. What if that's telling us what the most important thing in life is? It's relationships. What if that's the number one message that God brings? What if that's God's purpose, is relationships? And so we go in that direction. And it's a great direction. Talk about God as a triune being, a God of love, that throughout all eternity, there's been this loving relationship between the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He didn't create us because he was lonely. That's what I thought in Sunday school. God created us because he was lonely. He wasn't lonely. He was so enjoying love. And because of love, he was so motivated to create other beings in his image that could experience the love he was experiencing. I think that's the best narrative in the scriptures give us. And people are like, man, I never thought of that. Boom. And so these things start to come out. I know that relationships aren't easy. Every single person that I ever talked to has had a broken relationship. They've had a fight. They've had a falling out. They've lost a friend. They're not dating that one person ever again. You know, that kind of thing. And so relationships aren't easy. They're fragile. They can be broken. It's tough to restore. It takes both parties for a relationship to be restored and for a relationship to work. And they know that. They live that. And so we talk about, well, if relationships are so important and then they're fragile and they can break, what if there's someone who's an expert on relationships, an expert on repairing relationships, and somebody who's just, his credibility about love is off the charts. His modeling of forgiveness, which is the number one thing you need to repair a relationship, and the other thing is the humility to say, I was wrong. And you need those two to come together for the relationship to be saved and for that relationship to be restored. What if there's one person in history who does that? Do you know of somebody better than Jesus on the subject of love and relationships and forgiveness? I have never found one person give me a better example of love and forgiveness than Jesus Christ. Nobody's ever given me a better purpose for life than loving relationships. Of every single person I've talked to at the end of this conversation. And so where does that leave us? Loving relationships, Jesus is the model and the means for repairing those broken relationships. And I said, how much do you know about Jesus? Have you read the original ancient writings about the life of Jesus? The earliest writings about Jesus. They were written like 30 years after his death. 40, 50, 60 years. No, I have never read them. Would you like your own copy of the first four original short biographies of Jesus' life? Sure. And so I've got a knapsack with New Testaments in it. Pop one out and hand it over. And so this is a gift for you. And I show them where the first four books are. And I let them discover the other stuff later. You know? And they might have to run off to a class. Our time has gone longer than the 5 minutes he thought we might do at the very beginning. But, you know, he's stayed engaged, I've stayed engaged, and it's been all good. And after he leaves, I pray. And I just ask Jesus to touch the person's heart. If we had a really good connection, I mean, not only do I give him a Bible, I give him the business card with our campus website, our email contact information. If their subject, let's say he says, well, relationships, the greatest purpose of life is a relationship. I'll say, on our website, we have a video section. We videotaped a guy that came, his name was Andy Steiger, and he spoke on the meaning of life. And you could go to our website and check it out. I've had one guy say, well, if there's a God, why isn't it more obvious that he exists? I says, well, you know what, funny thing. We had a guy come on campus. His name was Andy Steiger. got that, Andy? Anyway, he spoke on, hey, God, why is it more obvious that you exist? Go check it out. Or because I remember his talk, and I remember the parable he used by Søren Kierkegaard, the parable of the prince. I'm able to share that with them. And if you want to know about the Kierkegaard's Parable of the Prince, go to www.bcitccm.net, hit videos, hit Andy Steiger, you will find the Parable of the Prince and Kierkegaard. Now, because we're in the Holy of Holies, and the next room is the outer court, you know, you guys are in the Holy Holies. We actually have to go through their room, so I'm waiting for them to stop talking. But I'm going to stop talking right now, and let's do some questions and answers about anything that I've had to say. Okay? Questions. Oh, back corner.
Now, I have an engagement with Jehovah's Witnesses a lot. And
okay.
Like, what advice could you give, like, maybe, like, I know, obviously, like, going through those steps and not see, like, being gracious to them and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, any more, like, you know, insight that you could give?
Well,
or advice? Maybe to lead them to tell them that Jesus is the way?
That's a good question. I haven't met many Jehovah's Witnesses on campus, but I think that, A, in the past, I've been afraid to talk to Jehovah's Witnesses and anybody of any cult. I've just been afraid. But really, we shouldn't be, should we? Because God's at work in each person's life. I don't think they understand the story of God. And they've switched it up. I mean, good works are so much a part of earning your way. They don't have a triune God of relationship and love. And they don't have the divine Jesus, the only way. And so really, I think the triune God of grace and love is a beautiful beginning point. And then Jesus is always the center. I spend much time on a lot of other debates. I bring them to Jesus. And then so anyway, I'm not sure that's too helpful. Sure, part two.
Quite a lot. I work out here, so I live in Coquitlam, but I commute to work, and it's about an hour's distance. And so any kind of quick conversation starters, like...
You're in the bus?
Yeah.
Public transit?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I'm a reserved person, and So actually, the spirituality questionnaire really provides sort of a way for me to have an excuse to talk to people. I'm not a naturally, you know, hey, how you doing? How's your day? And aren't the Canucks doing terrible? And then go from there. But I'm afraid I might not have the best answer for you. I'm relying on my pre-printed, scripted questionnaire. And then I just find myself seeing some things naturally unfold. You know, for the first couple times I did the questionnaire, it didn't really feel that natural. And I'm sure that'll be the same experience for you if you even try to write your own questionnaire and then do it in your neighborhood. But it's become natural. It really has. Another question. Thank you.
So basically, I was able to invite to some of my coworkers to our sports event through Winning the Church.
Okay.
And also I invite them to Christmas concert.
Excellent.
I think that message really touched one of my coworkers' heart.
Okay.
But she's telling me that my family is Buddhism background, so kind of like saying that kind of talk about Buddhism. So. I mean, I think that message really touched my heart.
Yeah.
Somehow, not really fully tried to commit it. Not try to commit to Jesus.
Mm.
So I don't know if you have any other questions.
Where to go with the conversation? I just go back to Jesus. How well do you know Jesus in the Jesus stories? That's my default mode. Always bringing people into a conversation about Jesus. You can ask them, what did you think about it and what touched your heart about it? And I know that they're going to have difficulties with the pressure of the loyalties to their family. And the only thing that's going to help them through that is really falling in love with Jesus and then navigating with the strength that Jesus gives to that family circle. And then them also respectfully engaging their loved ones and their family and friends in their discoveries about Jesus as well. Do you want to check through the door and see if they've dismissed? Good. Anybody else with questions and you don't want your coffee yet? I'm right here. But in deference to the time, thank you for coming. God bless you.